This episode features discussion of kidnapping, murder, and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. September 2001. Martin and Gracia Burnham sat in the muggy Philippine wilderness, hidden from view. The canopy above them was so thick, passing helicopters would never see them. The forest was so dense, it was nearly impenetrable.
They felt forgotten. It had been weeks since they'd heard from the outside world. They had been kidnapped for 4 months.
Their captors, the Abu Sayyaf, a ruthless militant group, were growing antsy. They had begun murdering hostages whose negotiations were taking too long.
Gracia had lost hope. The U.S. government would never pay their $1 million ransom. They would be beheaded, left dead on a mountainside.
But she had no idea that on this quiet September morning, half a world away, members of Al-Qaeda were about to execute a deadly terrorist attack that would change world politics forever.
The Burnhams were about to become the only hostages in history to have ransom paid for by the United States government. This is Hostage, the new Parcast podcast, telling the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also delve into psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations, as well as explore the psychological toll captivity takes on the human brain. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Irma Blanco. You can listen to all of Parcast podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our final episode on the kidnapping of Gracia and Martin Burnham, American missionaries taken hostage by religious extremists in the Philippines in 2001.
On May 27, 2001, Martin and Gracia Burnham were ripped from their beds by military insurgents. What followed was a year-long ordeal in the depths of the Philippine jungle as hostage negotiators attempted to negotiate ransom for the Burnhams' release.
Last week, we followed Gracia and Martin Burnham as they were kidnapped by the ruthless terrorist organization, the Abu Sayyaf, who routinely kidnap hostages for ransom to fund their holy war for an Islamic nation, independent of the Philippines.
This week, we'll follow the hostage negotiation that took place between the militant group and the FBI as the Burnhams became the only people in U.S. history to have ransom paid for by the U.S. government.
Gracia and Martin Burnham were American missionaries who had been living and working in the Philippines for 17 years.
On May 26, 2001, they spent the night at Dos Palmas Resort in celebration of their 18th wedding anniversary.
The next morning, on May 27th, military insurgents belonging to the extremist group Abu Sayyaf took Martin and Gracia hostage, along with 24 other hotel guests.
They spent the next 5 days being chased by the Philippine military through the jungle, a canopy so thick it was infamous for hiding militant groups for nearly 30 years.
This week, we conclude our deep dive into the hostage crisis that kept Gracia and Martin Burnham captive in the jungle for a year and 11 days.
After days of trudging through the jungle foliage, battling sleep deprivation, hunger, deteriorating hygiene, and a slow, steady mental break, the Abu Sayyaf began handcuffing Martin to trees around the clock.
For Gracia, this was a final straw. She told Martin that she wasn't going to walk another step. The situation felt hopeless. If the jungle didn't kill her soon, the Abu Sayyaf might.
The Abu Sayyaf had sent insurgents to begin hostage negotiations with the families and home countries of their captives. They set the Burnhams' ransom at a staggering $1 million, and Guillermo Sobrero, the only other American citizen in the camp, at another $1 million, $2 million in total.
To Gracia, This meant certain death. There was no way either of their families could foot that bill, and even if they could, the United States didn't pay ransom. They wouldn't facilitate the transfer of funds.
Interestingly, the U.S. policy on paying ransom has never been etched in stone. The government stopped paying ransom for hostages all the way back in 1800, when Thomas Jefferson announced that he would no longer pay African rulers for protection from pirates ransacking American ships. That led to the Barbary Wars.
But in 1980, President Jimmy Carter made the policy explicit. 52 American hostages were taken by Iranian revolutionaries in Tehran and held captive for 444 days. Carter denied their request for ransom money, saying, quote, "Our position is clear. The United States will not yield to blackmail," end quote. It took over a year of negotiation before the hostages were finally released.
That said, the U.S. does have a contentious history with trading prisoners and weapons for the release of hostages. Ronald Reagan traded arms with Lebanon in exchange for hostages in 1986. And in 2014, Barack Obama exchanged 5 imprisoned members of the Taliban for the release of Bo Bergdahl. Bergdahl was the U.S. soldier who went AWOL in Afghanistan in 2009 and was quickly captured by the Taliban, then held prisoner for 5 years.
In the case of the Burnhams and Guillermo Sobrero, the U.S. government was hesitant to get involved or make any such trade. The summer of 2001 was a completely different political climate, and as such, the Abu Sayyaf were having a hard time making the Burnhams into a political hostage crisis. At the time, the general public didn't really understand what Islamic extremists were or how they would soon impact politics the world over. The only way out, it would seem, was for the Burnhams' own families to raise $1 million in bail money, then wire it to Abu Sayyaf through a Philippine negotiator.
Families in the Philippines were already coordinating ransom money handoffs with the Abu Sayyaf through couriers. Depending on the hostages' status, ransom for the families could range between $10,000 and $500,000 U.S. dollars, or 3 million Philippine pesos.
The American captives, however, were forced to sit and wait. No money was coming in for them, and being rescued would take a miracle. They were stuck.
Tired, restless, scorched by the summer heat, and pinned to a tree, Martin fiddled with his handcuffs. He heard a click and turned to Gracia to show her.
The handcuffs were broken. They looked secure, but Martin was able to get them off easily. He said, "This will be our little secret, because one day we're going to have to get out of here."
From that moment on, everything became about timing.
But as June progressed, it became harder to carry on. Things only got worse for Guillermo, whose injured ankle was never able to properly heal. He was struggling with the grueling daily hikes, often spanning hours without water. He started snapping at his captors, being combative whenever possible.
About 2 or 3 weeks into the ordeal, the caravan of nearly 80 people arrived at a rustic farm hidden deep within the jungle. They set up camp there, throwing the hostages inside the bare-bones hut.
The hostages nearly collapsed to the floor, thrilled to have a day without traversing jungle terrain. As Gracia recouped, however, she couldn't help but overhear a conversation just beyond the hut.
A member of the Abu Sayyaf, Abu Sabaya, was on the phone, speaking with a hostage negotiator. Gracia remembers hearing one thing very distinctly. If they didn't pay the $1 million for the Burnhams within 72 hours, he was going to kill one of the white people. Guillermo Sobrero was American, but he was Peruvian-American. Gracia knew that meant it was either going to be her or Martin.
Gracia's heart began to race. She listened as hard as she could, committing every word to memory. She realized what was happening. The captor was on the phone with some kind of negotiator. The conversation wasn't going his way, and he was getting angry. He wanted $1 million for Martin and Gracia, $500,000 each. It was more money than she had made in her life. Her head spun.
Abu Sabaya knew that the hostages from Western countries typically brought in higher bounties, so he threatened to kill one of the white captives, knowing it would either line his pockets or make the news.
It was a political play, but Gracia thinks it was an accident. She said the moment he hung up the phone, he looked like he regretted making this threat. He clearly didn't believe the money was coming in, but now he had to follow through on the threat. Otherwise, he'd never be taken seriously.
Former FBI hostage negotiator Charles Regini worked for the Bureau from 1998 to 2009. In that time, he had gained a wealth of experience dealing with intense foreign negotiations involving kidnap, ransom, and extortion.
Regini said that they were hopeful that they could reason with these people, despite their knack for beheading hostages. To Regini, the Burnhams were just another international kidnapping case.
Regini landed in Manila in June 2001, ready to negotiate for the lives of Gracia and Martin Burnham and Guillermo Sobrero. When he landed in Manila, the kidnappings were headlining every news cycle.
At the time, the Abu Sayyaf were engaged in gun battles with Philippine armed forces on an almost daily basis around the country, and these kidnapping sprees were becoming a national embarrassment.
Despite this, Regini was confident in his ability to intervene. They were working with a negotiator who had developed a tenuous relationship with the Abu Sayyaf and had dealt with many of these ransom negotiations in the past.
That man was Special Action Force Commander General Benjamin Mogalong. Mogalong was a specialist for the Philippine Army on the Abu Sayyaf and had an intricate understanding of the religious war the Abu Sayyaf were raging.
As we covered last week, the Abu Sayyaf believed that the Muslim areas of the Philippines should be allowed to secede and form a sovereign Muslim nation.
Kidnappings were their way of funding a religious war that they believed would lead to the creation of an independent Islamic state.
Mogalong and Regini planned to work in tandem to negotiate with the Abu Sayyaf for the release of the hostages and return them to safety.
But they sorely underestimated the brutality of the Abu Sayyaf.
In a moment, we'll discover just how ruthless the Abu Sayyaf were. Now, back to the story.
FBI negotiator Charles Regini and Philippine General Benjamin Mogalong were surprised when Abu Sabaya, a member of the Abu Sayyaf, had threatened to behead one of the Burnhams within 72 hours if no ransom money was received. It was June 2001, and the negotiations were quickly breaking down.
One reason for that, according to Thomas Strenz, author of Psychological Aspects of Crisis Negotiation, is that hostage negotiations are most successful when the negotiator and captors can speak face to face. The more distance between the two parties, the harder it is for the negotiator to take control of the situation.
In order for a negotiation to be successful, the negotiator needs to be able to speak from a position of strength, with the possibility for immediate recourse if their instruction is not followed. In the U.S., a SWAT team would usually accompany a hostage negotiator, ready to storm the building if a negotiation goes south.
The distance between the Abu Sayyaf and Regini weakened Regini's position significantly.
He could not appeal to Sabaya's humanity man-to-man. He couldn't keep him on the phone and within close proximity. He couldn't send in a SWAT team if Sabaya hung up or hurt a hostage. It was the least ideal situation imaginable.
Meanwhile, back at the rebel camp, the Burnhams' backs were against a wall. They knew that one of them had only 3 days to live. The American government had not yet offered to pay ransom.
As we said last week, even though Americans account for only 20% of Western culture hostages abducted every year, they account for over 50% of hostage deaths. This is largely due to failed negotiations. Captors get angry and kill hostages they no longer believe are useful once they realize that no money is going to be exchanged.
And so the Burnhams knew Sabaya meant what he said. In 3 days' time, one of them would be murdered. Gracia began rehearsing a speech, what she was going to say when the Abu Sayyaf came to drag Martin into the jungle and behead him, how she would convince them to take her instead.
She knew Martin was rehearsing a similar plea. They spent every waking moment together, cherishing one another. Guillermo and his fiancée Faye were sick with worry.
If ever there was a time to escape, it was now. But there never seemed to be a window of opportunity. During this time in the hut, all the captives were kept inside together. The element of surprise was not on their side.
Hours turned into days, and slowly, the deadline approached. On the third morning, a heavy gloom hung over the camp. Sabaya had made a threat, one that not even the Abu Sayyaf had wanted to go through with. But if they didn't keep their word and murder one of the Burnhams, they would lose all power in the hostage negotiations.
The other hostages watched the Burnhams. The sorrow was tangible. Outside the small cottage, the Abu Sayyaf were huddled together, deep in conversation. Gracia watched them, knowing they were debating which life they were willing to lose.
Finally, the huddle broke up, and a few of the insurgents started walking over to the Burnhams, who clung to each other. This was it, the moment one of them would be dragged away to their death.
One insurgent grabbed Martin and began to lead him away from the hut. Gracia knew better than to scream. She followed as quickly as she could, as far as they would let her.
They dragged Martin to a tree and handcuffed him around it. Gracia stopped. She didn't understand. Almost on autopilot, she said, "What are you doing? He won't be able to sleep."
One of the militants screamed at her to shut up. She didn't say another word. The air was thick with tension. It was palpable. Sabaya's outburst was costing the Abu Sayyaf $500,000.
They were stressed. Gracia couldn't breathe. She watched the Abu Sayyaf circle Martin, shifting from side to side, ready to behead the love of her life.
Gracia waited on bated breath. They weren't moving. She was confused.
Then she realized, maybe they were restraining him. Maybe they were going to behead her instead.
The Abu Sayyaf looked on edge, upset. They slowly began to huddle up again.
Gracia felt her heart pounding in her ears. The camp was silent.
They waited and waited. Then one of the Abu Sayyaf whispered something to another militant who ran back towards the hut.
Martin and Gracia wondered what hell could come next.
It was Guillermo. Two members of the Abu Sayyaf marched Guillermo out of the cabin.
Another member of the Abu Sayyaf told Guillermo the men wanted to talk to him about medical supplies.
Martin and Gracia exchanged looks. Something was amiss. But Guillermo had been having trouble with his foot since the beginning of the capture. Maybe they had gotten medical supplies for him. Guillermo limped over to Gracia and handed her his bag, asking her to watch it until he got back.
The Abu Sayyaf then led Guillermo out of the campsite.
Then the crowd encircling the Burnhams dispersed. They were left alone, Martin tied to a tree to await certain doom.
Doom that never seemed to come. The day grew long and slowly faded into night, but still nobody came to kill either of them. They sat 50 feet from the hut, Martin handcuffed to a tree. As the night grew cold, Gracia fell asleep, still clinging to Martin.
When she awoke in the morning, she was lying on the cold jungle floor. She bolted upright and looked around, breathing a heavy sigh of relief. There, next to her, was Martin, still handcuffed to the tree.
Members of the Abu Sayyaf came over to uncuff Martin and toss the Burnhams back into the hut. As she sat inside the hut, the events of yesterday slowly returned to her like a hangover.
Her thoughts fled to Guillermo. Where was he? She looked out on the yard and her stomach dropped. His bag was still lying in the grass, alone. She grabbed it, clung to it, waiting for him to come back to reclaim it.
Then she overheard a conversation that would shatter her. Two members of the Abu Sayyaf were just outside the hut, laughing with one another. One playfully mocked, "Don't kill me. I want to see my sons." Then he pantomimed a beheading.
Gracia's blood ran cold. She clenched Guillermo's bag to her chest. She could feel hot, white tears welling in her eyes. She turned to Martin and whispered, "They killed Guillermo."
Martin looked at her in disbelief as she explained what she'd overheard. They watched the men laugh over having beheaded Guillermo. Ice ran through Gracia's veins. She hated them. She prayed for their deaths. She seethed as she watched them laughing about Guillermo's last moments as he begged for his life.
Enraged, she charged from the hut and confronted Suleiman, asking if they'd killed Guillermo the day before when they led him out of the camp. Suleiman said, quote, "We released him, but without his head."
Gracia realized they never had medical supplies. They just didn't want Guillermo to put up a struggle as they marched him to his death. But instead of lashing out, she collected herself and found Faye, Guillermo's fiancée. With all the courage she could muster, Gracia told Faye what had happened, and Faye collapsed. At first, she refused to believe it, but as realization set in, Faye was overwhelmed with grief.
Gracia held back tears, trying to be strong. She knew the horrific truth, that Guillermo had died so that the Abu Sayyaf could say they killed an American. She didn't understand. Why Guillermo? Why not one of them?
Hostage negotiator Charles Regini has since said that what kept the Burnhams alive most likely was their demeanor. They were overall cooperative and didn't cause undue trouble for the Abu Sayyaf.
Guillermo Sobrero, however, had developed an antagonistic relationship with the Abu Sayyaf, constantly complaining about his ankle and fighting back whenever possible. His open defiance and combative attitude could have put him in the line of fire.
Whatever the reason for his execution, a depression set in over the camp, a heaviness unlike anything before. Gracia and Martin mourned the loss of Guillermo. But something else had changed. Something among the Abu Sayyaf. The decision to kill Guillermo seemed to have caused a rift in the group.
In fact, a former anonymous member of Abu Sayyaf has since said that the killing of Guillermo was decided by Abu Sabaya alone. Sabaya was a radical who loved violence. The anonymous former member said that Guillermo's beheading had made him sick, that for a moment he thought of killing Sabaya. He knew that Sabaya was careening out of control and that eventually Abu Sabaya would ruin everything.
The weeks drew into months. Slowly, Philippine hostages began to be released to their families in exchange for ransoms up to $500,000. The Abu Sayyaf also began to lose steam. There was a small rift in the group that was slowly tearing. As the summer of 2001 dragged on, the Abu Sayyaf seemed restless. They had been on this hostage mission for 3 months with little to show for it.
Throughout the summer, nothing changed, except for their location. The group was constantly on the move, trying to stay one step ahead of the Philippine army, who was tracking them. They marched through the jungle, weathering endless days of heat and starvation.
But back in Kansas, wheels were starting to turn. Gracia's sister had begun to take action of her own. She had decided that she would begin writing the White House about her sister Gracia once every 3 days, until someone finally answered her. She wanted to keep Martin and Gracia in the public eye and on the mind of the president.
At first, she felt blown off. The White House hadn't dignified her with a response. But only a few weeks later, everything changed. September 11th, 2001, a day that would live in infamy. On that day, President George Bush said, quote, "Our war on terror starts with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there," end quote. And those words would prove to be the key to extracting the Burnhams from the jungle.
A few weeks later, Gracia's sister discovered a link between Osama bin Laden and the Abu Sayyaf. Bin Laden had been funding the militant group, sending them to training camps, and aiding them in their religious war.
In small part because of Gracia's sister, and in large part thanks to White House personnel, President Bush pledged to aid the Philippines in its war against the Abu Sayyaf.
Huge amounts of resources were funneled into the Philippines, and the eradication of the Abu Sayyaf began. Joint task forces, special forces, and the U.S. Air Force were deployed to Manila to provide aid and intelligence. Hundreds of special ops were sent in, which the Muslim population protested greatly.
Remember, the last time the United States was in the Philippines, the U.S. had inadvertently taken power away from the Muslim community. The community did not want Americans to return.
And now the Abu Sayyaf had two American prisoners hidden deep in the mountains. They had cards to play. As the Abu Sayyaf were flushed out and killed off by the Philippine and American military, the question became, would the Burnhams be used as a bargaining chip or murdered in retribution? By late November 2001, the military had made enough headway ambushing the Abu Sayyaf that the hostage negotiators on the ground began searching for potential intermediaries that might know where the Burnhams were and could move between the groups.
At the same time, the Abu Sayyaf had recently begun to grant access to a Philippine field reporter named Arlene de la Cruz. The Abu Sayyaf wanted to be in the news so long as it was on their terms. It was an excellent tool for recruitment and for communicating with hostage negotiators. By working with Arlene de la Cruz, they were able to give interviews and control their own narrative. De la Cruz understood the importance of her tenuous relationship with the terrorist organization and was careful to maintain it.
In late November, De La Cruz was contacted by the hostage negotiators and told them that, based on what she knew from her contact with the Abu Sayyaf, there might be a window of opportunity to make contact with the military group and retrieve the Burnhams.
She agreed to meet with the Abu Sayyaf in late November and take a message from the Burnhams back to the negotiators as proof they were still alive. She was loaded into a car and told once they passed a military checkpoint, she would need to walk 4 hours into the jungle, accompanied by nobody but the Abu Sayyaf, to meet up with the Burnhams. In an astounding act of bravery, she agreed.
She passed the checkpoint, her last chance to abandon ship. She was taken from the vehicle shortly afterwards and began walking into the thick, nearly impassable jungle. After 30 minutes, they said she had arrived. She was shocked. For all their talk, for all their disappearing acts, the Abu Sayyaf had been camping out just 30 minutes from a military checkpoint. She realized that they truly had eyes everywhere in the jungle.
She waited around for about 15 minutes, watching the Abu Sayyaf. Most of the militants were children, 15, maybe 16 years old.
Then, from a makeshift tent on the edge of camp, emerged Gracia and Martin Burnham.
Gracia couldn't believe what she was seeing, a reporter and a cameraman here to hear their plea. It was either November 23rd or 24th, 2001, and she and her husband Martin had been captured by the Abu Sayyaf for just over 6 months.
Martin walked towards the reporters, confused at first, but as the camera rolled, he gave a reserved, calculated, but impassioned plea for the U.S. government to negotiate their release.
Then the cameraman turned towards Gracia. She wasn't sure what to say. She hadn't expected to speak. But all her emotions came bubbling up, The months of danger, gunfire, stress, the grueling days of marching through the jungle, the long hours of boredom spent next to Martin, handcuffed to a tree, it all rose to the surface.
She cried. She begged for someone to negotiate their release. She told a harrowing story of bullets whizzing past their head as they lay on the ground, whispering, "I love you," to one another.
She said that every time a twig snapped, Gracia thought it was gunfire. She woke in the middle of the night hearing gunfire. She was shell-shocked. She needed to come home.
Then she admitted the most heartbreaking truth of all, that one day a bullet wouldn't whiz past her head. It would kill her. She and Martin would be dead, and the world would say, "Oh well, there goes the Burnhams. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time."
But for the reporter Arlene, the most interesting thing about the interview was Abu Sabaya, the militant leader that had ordered the beheading of Guillermo Sobrero. Normally, he was bombastic, boastful, and terrifying. But this Sabaya was even-keeled and calm. It was abnormal.
Arlene took note of it. As she headed back toward civilization, she started to realize something. She thought back to the camp and realized that no other prominent leaders of the Abu Sayyaf had been present. She wondered, was Sabaya acting timid because he was scared?
Then it dawned on her. The Abu Sayyaf had left Sabaya to deal with the Burnhams alone. He was on his own, vulnerable, weak, and suddenly there was a crack in the glass.
Arlene reported back to the hostage negotiators. This might be the break they were looking for.
Next, we'll see how cracks in the Abu Sayyaf's ranks might give the Burnhams a window to escape or put them further into harm's way.
Now back to the story.
By mid-December 2001, 14 of the 24 hostages had been released, but Martin and Gracia were left to linger, slowly wasting away in the jungle. They didn't know it yet, but by this point, they were only halfway through this grueling ordeal.
During a rare, peaceful moment, Gracia told Martin goodbye. She said that she wanted to tell him what he meant to her now, when things were quiet, so that in case they died, they would have no regrets. It was one of the few fond memories she has from that entire year.
Gracia and Martin didn't know it, but by doing this, they were actually increasing their chances of survival. This process of preparing for emotional turmoil and grief is called, quote, preparing for psychological reactions.
According to former FBI negotiator Thomas Strenz, mentally prepping for the absolute worst makes a person that much more capable of surviving their most dreaded fears. Mentally walking through a worst-case scenario, living it through fantasy, and being prepared for the possibility of it makes a person a survivor. These people are most likely to walk away from hostage situations and go on to lead healthy, productive, fulfilled lives after their ordeal. Those who crumble under the stress and anxiety of their capture are called succumbers and have a much harder time readjusting.
But despite having prepared for the worst, nothing happened. The months dragged on with no word from the hostage negotiators. But among the Abu Sayyaf, cracks were beginning to show. Gracia and Arlene were both right to assume that the Abu Sayyaf were beginning to break apart. What had started as a gung-ho crew of 80 captors had slowly dwindled. By spring, barely 14 Abu Sayyaf remained. They would wake up some mornings to discover another 10 or 15 men had abandoned the camp.
Meanwhile, on February 22, 2002, President Bush altered the U.S. policy on paying ransom. He had signed a policy that left the door open for paying ransom to kidnappers, and hostage negotiator Regini decided to use Gracia's sister Mary Jones as a point of contact to jumpstart the hostage negotiations.
The Abu Sayyaf are extremists, and Sabaya was radical even for their tastes. This added complexity to the hostage negotiations that would need to take place if Regini had any hope of returning the Burnhams to their family.
Terrorists and extremists are notoriously hard to negotiate with because they deal in absolutes and have a much grander political agenda than, say, a man who holds a bank teller hostage in the hopes of getting cash.
But in their political agenda lies their weakness. According to psychological aspects of crisis negotiation, terrorists love media coverage and are willing to take risks to broaden their platform.
For this reason, Regini knew that reopening negotiations in a public setting, using someone as sympathetic and attention-grabbing as Gracia's own sister, was the perfect way to reestablish contact with Abu Sabaya.
Mary flew to the Philippines and made a radio announcement aimed towards reaching the Abu Sayyaf. News stations quickly picked up the story and broadcast the radio recording around the country, just as Regini had intended. In the broadcast, Mary said that her brother-in-law and sister were not worth much in the way of ransom money, but they had loving families who wanted them home soon. She gave Abu Sabaya a phone number to call to get in touch with negotiators. They were ready to pay.
The Abu Sayyaf took the bait. Sabaya called. It was the moment Regini had been waiting for. To Regini, extracting the Burnhams quickly was of the utmost importance, and now that he could pay for their release, he was hopeful that this could all be over in a matter of weeks.
While it's unclear how much money was initially offered to Abu Sabaya, Regini admitted that the number was low, but that was part of his plan. Abu Sabaya had asked for $1 million in exchange for both Burnhams, but this was a trick. If Regini would have agreed to that price off the bat, Sabaya would have immediately asked for more.
This was a long con. By crushing Sabaya's expectations, they forced him to realistically negotiate for Gracia and Martin. As expected, Sabaya rejected the initial offer. Regini came back with more money, but barely more than he had initially said, just to temper expectations.
The point here wasn't to fully agree on a price. Regini was just trying to keep Sabaya on the phone. By drawing out this process and slowly increasing the ransom amount incrementally, Regini was tricking Sabaya into thinking he was accomplishing more out of this negotiation than he actually had.
But finally, after multiple offers and an exhaustive conversation, Sabaya accepted a ransom amount. It's unclear as to how much was eventually agreed upon, but it was a far cry from $1 million. The process had been like pulling teeth, but Regini came out ahead. In that moment, the Burnhams became the only hostages to ever have their ransom paid for by the U.S. government.
In April 2002, after 11 months in captivity, Sabaya and a few other members of the Abu Sayyaf asked Martin and Gracia to sit down. They told them that overnight, a courier from the U.S. Embassy had met with a member of the Abu Sayyaf and delivered funds. Their ransom had been paid.
Gracia stared at Sabaya in disbelief. Time seemed to slow. After 11 months of suffering in the jungle, she was going home. She turned to Martin, who embraced her, a smile creeping across his face. Tears began to well up in her eyes. It had been months since they spoke to the reporter. She thought they had been abandoned, and now she felt a sliver of hope.
But their joy would be cut short. Sabaya pursed his lips and told them the money given was not enough. The Burnhams wouldn't be leaving anytime soon.
Gracia felt like she might lose her mind. They had been so close. They had gotten the money. She couldn't understand what had happened.
What she would later discover was that the courier had been arranged by the Abu Sayyaf and had kept a large chunk of the money. He had also given money to the members of the Abu Sayyaf that had abandoned Sabaya on his kidnapping mission. By the time the money got to Sabaya, it was a fraction of the agreed-upon price. Sabaya was too embarrassed to admit that he had been betrayed. Gracia didn't think this had ever happened to him before. The Abu Sayyaf was cracking.
Meanwhile, the Philippine army had been closing in on the Abu Sayyaf, aided by the U.S. military. The intelligence operations the two countries had been running in tandem were tightening the noose around the Abu Sayyaf.
The Burnhams spent the final 3 months of their capture being forced higher and higher into the mountains. They started to run out of food. Even the Abu Sayyaf were starving.
Gracia remembers the longest stretch without food spanned 9 days. The entire camp was starving. They were on the brink of exhaustion. But still, they kept moving, crawling up the mountain at a snail's pace. She thought they might starve to death or collapse from exhaustion.
Finally, on the morning of June 7th, 2002, they stopped to make camp and rest while some of the Abu Sayyaf went foraging for food. The air was unusually still. The jungle felt quiet, like it was holding a secret. The Abu Sayyaf began to shift from side to side, growing restless. Something was wrong. The Abu Sayyaf called it having the goonie-goonies, an unsettling feeling that, at any moment, something bad was going to happen.
Gracia and Martin strung a hammock between two trees, trying not to focus on the nerves at camp. They said a prayer together, then laid down for a cat nap. At first, Gracia had trouble sleeping. She looked up into the thick canopy above, eerily still for the early afternoon. But slowly, she fell asleep. And as Gracia's thoughts faded away, something else in the jungle began to stir.
On the other side of the mountain, the Philippine army was closing in. They moved quietly, knowing they were 100 yards from the Abu Sayyaf. They crept up the mountainside and hid in the foliage, waiting for the right moment to strike.
Gracia's eyes flung open as she registered the gunfire filling the camp. She turned to Martin, whose face was filled with panic. They scrambled to figure out what was going on.
A sharp pain struck Gracia's leg. She'd been shot. She fell to the ground in agony. She could feel Martin lying behind her, perfectly still. She followed suit. Martin had always said that in a gun battle, it was best to stay still until someone told you what to do.
A heavy rain began to fall as bullets whizzed around them. Gracia saw men around her fall, but it felt like a haze. She kept perfectly still, lying next to Martin, who was breathing heavily behind her.
She tried to look dead. As the Abu Sayyaf began to retreat, Abu Sabaya ran to grab the Burnhams. He was disheartened when he saw them and screamed, quote, "Forget them, they're dead."
Gracia's heart leapt as she watched her captors run into the jungle, chased by the Philippine military. She turned to Martin and grabbed him, but he didn't move.
Confused, she scooted up closer to him and called his name. No response. He felt heavy, lifeless.
Then she saw the blood leaking out of his shirt, staining the ground beneath him.
Members of the Philippine military began to encircle them as Gracia began to call Martin's name, begging him to respond.
The soldiers grabbed Gracia under the arms and began to drag her away. A shot of pain ran up her leg and she cried out. She reached out for Martin's lifeless body as the soldiers dragged her up the hill towards a helicopter.
She cried, screamed with grief. They had just left Martin, her best friend, dead on the hillside, alone in the rain.
After a year and 11 days of surviving together, Gracia couldn't believe that it was the rescue attempt that had taken Martin's life. He was her best friend and confidant for 2 decades, and just like that, he was gone.
In the end, the Burnhams' location was discovered after the exhaustive covert efforts of the Philippine military, assisted by U.S. Special Forces. The Philippine soldiers on the ground were the first to admit that the hostage rescue was botched and that Martin should not have died.
Agent Regini was especially upset to learn of Martin's passing. He felt that it could have been avoided had the military not been shooting indiscriminately before laying eyes on targets.
While Regini was largely responsible for the negotiations with the Abu Sayyaf, he had very little control over the actual extraction of the Burnhams from the jungle. That loss of control, he believes, is what cost Martin his life.
The United States has recently begun to revert back to its old policy against paying ransom for hostages. The botched deal with the Burnhams only further proved their point. Paying ransom doesn't work. They were reluctant to try it again.
Much of the circumstances of the Burnhams' capture was beyond the control of the army and the government. But Regini says there are a few takeaways that could be helpful in hostage negotiations moving forward.
First, maintain a positive, neutral demeanor with captors and try to blend in. Don't make waves. Don't give your captors reason to single you out. Lastly, have faith. This is where Gracia and Martin certainly excelled. Keeping faith in yourself, the situation, and your government could mean the difference between life and death.
Since returning to the United States, Gracia has dedicated herself to her ministry, to living a life of service. She works to honor Martin's memory every day.
Sabaya was shot and killed off the coast of Zamboanga in the southern Philippines 2 weeks after Martin's death in a sting operation spearheaded by the CIA and the Philippine government. Suliman and 80 other members of the Abu Sayyaf were put on trial for the kidnappings at Dos Palmos Resort. 14 were convicted and given life sentences for kidnapping. Many others were killed in gun skirmishes with the Philippine army in the weeks that followed. But that hardly eradicated the terrorist organization from the island.
The Abu Sayyaf are alive and well today, still operating out of the Philippines. Al-Qaeda eventually proved too conservative for their tastes. As of now, the Abu Sayyaf identifies with the Islamic State, or ISIS, and continues to kidnap and behead tourists to fund their twisted war.
They have proved nearly impossible to eradicate fully. They still move amongst the civilian population, undetected, hiding in the shadows. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Aaron Land and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.